Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
And welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of July 20th, 2017. Today we're joined by our frequent guest, the prolific commentator, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, Mr. D.R. Tucker?
Doing well. How are you doing?
And we're pleased to be joined as well by Mariah Tinger. How are you doing, Mariah?
I'm feeling fabulous. Thanks.
That's great. Well, I hope that you are both ready for a little legal scrutiny, because we're going to talk some legal stuff tonight or legislative stuff tonight. So let me just set the context for the first discussion, and that is that with the advent of the climate-denying, Chinese-hoax-supporting theory president, effectively all federal work on climate change has kind of ground to a halt. I mean, we've all agreed that's a reality. One of the things that has been surprisingly robust is the fact that the states and the cities are taking over the responsibility and are prepared to push forward a climate agenda, even in the face of federal malfeasance, I think is the word, nonfeasance perhaps is the word. All right. But anyway, this passed our friends out in California, which of course is the 11th. If California was on its own, it would be something like the 11th biggest economy in the world, right? So California matters all by itself. And they had what amounted to a true cap and trade system. Well, I guess how true? I'll ask DR in a second. I'm setting this up for DR to hit the home run with. The cap and trade bill in California recently came up for an extension, and there was some suspense around it. And tell me, DR, what happened out in California, which is the climate leader for the country in this sense, in terms of their cap and trade legislation that was recently voted on?
The California legislature passed a bill, I believe it's Assembly Bill 398, although it may not have the correct number. That extends to 2030 the cap and trade policy that was initiated in 2006 as part of the California Global Warming Solutions Act. It's gotten a lot of coverage by virtue of the fact that several Republicans in the state legislature voted in favor of this bill years after federal Republicans disavowed cap and trade as cap and tax. That was the nonsense term they came up for it. The bill, however, is controversial because part of the provision in the bill that allowed it to get this sort of support is there is a provision in the bill that prevents the California Air Resources Board, which is a very influential board that is, if you go back to who killed the electric car, paved the way in terms of, you know, pushing forward for clean cars, electric vehicles. It prevents the California Air Resources Board from directly regulating emissions from sources that are subject to cap and trade regulations. This was a provision that supposedly Republicans were in favor of because they preferred market-based efforts to reduce emissions to mandates to reduce emissions. But nevertheless, there were a number of prominent environmental groups that were opposed to this provision and feel that the bill was watered down as a result.
So the CARB, the C-A-R-B, the California Air Resources Board, cannot do anything about those sources of emissions that are under the cap and trade bill, right?
That is correct.
So, DR, do you know enough? So, I'm not up to speed fully on the California legislation. I don't know, Mariah, if you are, but I mean, what are the things that are regulated by the cap and trade? Do you know, DR?
Obviously, from what I've read, it's basically sort of emissions from vehicles and what have you, and there would be subject to the cap, which is why you still hear this fear mongering about, you know, gas prices going out of control. But Think Progress notes that the provision that I just mentioned that prevents, you know, the California Air Resources Board from cracking down on emissions There has been reporting indicating that the Western States Petroleum Association, which includes members like ExxonMobil, BP, and Shell, had a hand in the crafting of this provision. So in other words, the Western States Petroleum Association apparently was of the view that they don't mind a market-based regulation of emissions, but mandates of emissions are problematic.
Right, because the mandates of, so the mandates would come from the California Air Resources Board, right?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Well, I guess the other thing that I'm not sure came up in the discussion, but we talked about it before in the past, is the idea that there's some level of social justice involved in that or environmental justice in that the cap and trade regulations somehow don't have any impact on disadvantaged communities, right? They were saying, I remember there was some discussion of the big oil trucks driving through Richmond, California or something, and that the cap and trade was not addressing that at all, right? It was, mm-hmm. Do you know if there's any sort of nod to environmental justice as part of the cap and trade? Because I guess the point was that the California Air Resources Board was giving away credits to, if you wanted to buy a Tesla, which of course you can only do if you're a .com millionaire, right? And then if you're just a guy on the street, you're not going to buy a Tesla, so you're not taking advantage of all that tax money, right?
Unless it's the Model 3.
So this is the Model 3, right? Maybe not. Maybe even I could buy one of those. But I guess the point being that as we implement these cap and trade systems, it's important to understand how that interacts with environmental justice issues, because they're all tied together, right? And you don't want to like further advantage one group by having, you know, energy rebates to put solar panels on your house. Which takes it, you know, if you have people that don't own houses, right? Somehow it's got to be spread around fairly. So I guess I don't know what's in the California cap and trade bill, but that's just a point to keep in mind, right?
Exactly. Think Progress, in their reporting, they quoted Masada Decenthouse of 350.org in California, saying that the bill, quote, doesn't do enough to protect the vulnerable communities or achieve California's targets for reducing carbon pollution, unquote. And the criticism from environmental justice advocates is that this bill essentially was born of an effort to essentially play patty cake with the powerful fossil fuel industry in California. Although, to play devil's advocate, you can argue that so long as Citizens United is on the books when it comes to formulating any sort of carbon policy, you are forced to play patty cake with those who have the power.
You're going to play patty cake with the person who has the patty.
Going to have a role in this.
No, I agree. And I think we're sort of critiquing what California's done. I mean, they deserve kudos for having a cap and trade legislation, right? I mean, it's good on them for pushing forward. And I think their governor, of course, when I was younger, he was known as Jerry Moonbeam, the Governor Moonbeam, right, back in the 70s, because he was such a – but, I mean, he's going to have an international climate summit of different countries in California, right, of different U.S. states. And speaking of which, there was a thing in – people should know that the National Governors Association was recently held its meeting this past weekend down in Providence. And, of course, you probably heard the press about people showing up to lobby the governors about the health care bill. Right, so this is just last weekend, it was still an issue. But there were also a lot of climate protesters there calling for the governors to take stronger action in the face of federal inaction. So there you go. All right, so cap and trade, boom, good on California. I mean, there's other stuff going on in California that has some interest for us. Tell me, what happened out in Marin County? Last time I was in Marin County, I rode a bike with my son across the Golden Gate Bridge, and it was this long, gorgeous glide down the Golden Gate into Marin County. Beautiful place to visit. I'd love to live there, but tell me, what did they do out in Marin County?
Yes, well, Marin County and San Mateo County in South California, they've both separately filed lawsuits in state court. Very interesting that they choose state court as opposed to federal courts. And also the city of Imperial Beach, California, filed lawsuits against several oil and coal companies, among them Chevron, ExxonMobil, ConocoPhillips, and Royal Dutch Shell, claiming that these companies knew the damage that would be that would be caused to places like Marin County and San Mateo County and Imperial Beach by rising sea levels, mm-hmm. by carbon pollution, and that therefore they should be on the hook for the damages and the relocation and the other, you know, sort of consequences of the climate crisis that are going to befall these regions. According to the San Francisco Chronicle, quote, these lawyers contend that the oil companies knew about the damage their actions were causing, denied it, and sought to discredit scientific findings that greenhouse gas emissions were heating the Earth's atmosphere, unquote. Now, there's been some interesting legal analysis that frankly challenged my own thinking about this, because when I read these cases, I figured that this would, you know, these cases would be doomed, similar to the famous Kivalina versus ExxonMobil case and the Comer versus Murphy Oil case.
And just remind everybody, the Kivalina case was because you couldn't really tag the Kivalina was a similar case by somebody named Mr. and Mrs. Kivalina, right? And
mm-hmm. the Alaskan village of Kivalina.
Yeah, village.
Oh, okay. And they could not connect the damage to a particular oil company, so they mm-hmm. said forget it, right? You couldn't have the suit.
Yes, and Comer versus Murphy Oil was where the courts rejected a claim by victims of Hurricane Katrina that the oil companies who were the defendants in that case, their pollution caused Katrina and caused
because it's too diffuse a logical connection, right? You can't
exactly.
quite draw that line. All right.
But in this case, the interesting wrinkle is that the plaintiffs in this case are specifically citing the Exxon News stories, specifically citing that, you know, the reporting from Inside Climate News and the LA Times showing that at the very least Exxon, mm-hmm. you know, had all this information dating back decades, recognizing the risks and the potential harm to the planet, which was obviously, you know, the plaintiffs in Kivalina and Comer didn't have access to that. So my take, and I'm not a lawyer, my sense is that if the plaintiffs can prove that all of the defendants individually knew, did their own research, knew, and then hid it, then we'll probably see this case being settled out of court. If not, then it may well lose the lawsuit. But I do recognize that they may have a stronger claim than the plaintiffs in Kivalina and Comer, because again, going back to the fact that they're actually citing, you know, this Exxon New case, and there are other mm-hmm. but other reports about the American Petroleum Institute and other such entities knowing. Although somebody does make an interest, there is one interesting angle to this that we do have to take into account. Where there was one legal expert who was quoted in one of these stories, basically saying that part of the problem and presumably if the courts rule against the plaintiffs, this will be something that is cited, the fact that the companies didn't themselves burn the fossil fuel. Mm-hmm. They sold mm-hmm. gasoline to people who put it in their cars and drove around. And I'm reminded of in the Comer versus Murphy Oil case, one of the judges saying something that sort of made me lose faith in the hope that the courts would you know pursue justice on this. The judge wrote something to the effect of, the reason why this is so complicated is that the plaintiffs, the defendants, the court itself, and the country within which the court operates all use the products made by the defendants. Mm-hmm. So that sort of makes things a bit difficult. Who knew climate litigation could be so complicated?
Nobody knew.
Well, I mean, I wonder if, you know, a lot of times the sort of what we're dealing with climate science and, you know, the mystery around, not the mystery, the supposed doubt around climate science gets aligned with the doubt around cigarette smoke, right? And mm-hmm. the tobacco companies, they weren't giving people cancer. They were providing a product that people could buy that gave them cancer. So, you know, that seems like a similar wrinkle in this problem in that, yes, people are buying the gas from them and driving it around, but how much money is being funneled into depressing technologies that could get us off of their gases? Mm-hmm. And they know that their gases are, they're burning their fuels are poisonous. So, well,
and I think that was the argument about the tobacco company. I mean, they knew mm-hmm. it was bad and they sold it anyway. And so mm-hmm. nobody was forced to smoke, as you rightly point out, right? No one was forced mm-hmm. to smoke, but I mean, they were selling the stuff and just, I mean, I suppose it's a stretch to say that no one can live without fossil fuels nowadays. I mean, it's certainly embedded in our culture, but it's not, I mean, I agree with you, Mariah. I mean, it's not, it's a, it's, you can make the argument that they knew and they sold a dangerous product.
Right. Well, and then funding disinformation campaigns and creating doubt about the science, I would think that's a big problem for them. And I have to wonder if maybe the fossil fuel companies are starting to run scared a little bit. I'll have to, you know, just ask your guys' opinion about this, where, you know, now all of a sudden they are saying, let's do carbon taxes and cap and trades. And, you know, they're seeing these lawsuits coming their way. And, you know, DR, as you were saying, if they go to court, all of a sudden all the information they know is, again, I'm not a lawyer, I don't know all the speak either, but gets subpoenaed, is that right? They, you know, all of their information has to be put out on the table. So if they have all of these records that show they knew climate science and that burning fossil fuels was going to pollute our air and cause global warming, if that gets put out into the public sphere, they can't take that back. They can't hide that anymore. So I wonder if they're running scared a little bit.
I think that they are. I mean, the value of these companies is in their brand, right? Well, we say value. I mean, the brand is the value is in their stockpile of oil that they have, but they want to maintain that brand. And I think the public shaming and, you know, the bad press that they get depresses stock prices, right? Divestment movement does it. All this bad press, I think that's it. They are afraid of that. I think you're right. They're looking much more carefully at what's coming, and I think they're taking it more and more seriously, all these various kinds of lawsuits, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that the famous one that we keep bouncing back to is the Giuliana case, right? And this is a person, a young woman, a young teenager named Giuliana. I'm not sure. I think it's the last name, right? And that is the public trust case that the government the government has a public trust to protect the environment for future generations. That's what their job is. And since they're not doing it, the courts need to force them to do that. Right, DR, you were saying there was some development in the public trust Giuliana case this week?
Jim Hansen, who is related to one of the plaintiffs in that case, put out a I think it was a peer-reviewed study basically pointing to the risks that, you know, future generations are facing, and basically making the point that this is why, you know, these plaintiffs are in the right to sort of pursue this avenue. Although to go back to the point about whether or not these companies are running scared, this goes back to my longstanding cynicism about whether or not these cases will ultimately be successful, whether this is the Giuliana case, whether it's the case that's got a lot of coverage in Pennsylvania, where a group of Catholic nuns are trying to stop a pipeline company from taking their land by eminent domain, whether it's even to a certain extent the case in Marin County. And it goes back to my theory that courts and judges are the courts are inherently conservative institutions. That doesn't mean they're all, you know, big Republicans. It means that there's a culture now that causes courts and judges to defer to the status quo in a way that didn't exist generations ago. When you go back to when courts challenged the status quo, when judges, courageous judges, challenged the status quo, and all the crap they took, even in that era, when you go back to, you know, impeach Earl Warren, when you go back to, you know, when then Congressman Gerald Ford tried to chase Justice William O. Douglas off the Supreme Court, all years and years of that, I think, have built up to where you have a culture and a legal climate now where there are a lot of judges who are afraid to do anything to challenge the status quo because they know they'll be smeared, they'll be attacked, partisan operatives will try to get them off the court, and therefore it's easier to pass the buck, not rock the boat, and not confront, you know, serious challenges. So the reason why I'm so deeply cynical about the Giuliana case is that the plaintiffs are saying that they have a right to a stable climate. If a judge or a group of judges declares that those plaintiffs have a right to a stable climate, that judge or those group of judges are essentially claiming, in effect, they will claim that is unconstitutional on a certain level to operate a coal-fired power plant or to operate a coal company or an oil company or a fracked gas company. Can you imagine no pun intended with regard to the nun case, the holy hell that would rain down upon a judge or an appellate court judge or appellate court judges by all the interests that are promoting of the fossil fuel industry if a judge were to make a ruling like that. I think most judges, even judges who recognize the severity of the problem, are scared to death of somebody calling them judicial activists.
I got to push back a little bit, Dio. I think that the judges are inherently, I mean, conservative in the true sense of, you know, they want to do the least they can, make the least law they can, and but of course all judges refer back to the precedents, right? And so I think the judges are trying to do the right thing, and I think that in the past the Supreme Court or courts reflect the zeitgeist, reflect the attitude of the time, and as the attitude of the time changes, then I think the courts tend to follow. So, and I agree with you. I mean, they're in this media age of 140 character nuclear attacks, right? I mean, you know, it's tough to be a judge, but I'm not sure that they are unwilling to exercise the responsibilities of being a jurist for fear they'll be attacked. Certainly in states where they're appointed for life, right, as opposed to where they're voted in. But I mean, I think that, I mean, I hope you're wrong. I hope it's not. Mariah, do you think that that DR cynicism is well held? Or you can talk. Leave it to you to talk him out of it.
Well, you know, it's a very terrifying idea. Certainly, you know, of course, there's King's. I think it's Martin Luther King's quote that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. And I hope that that's true. That, you know, as you say, as attitudes shift, so will the rulings and so will the way that, you know, people are willing to take a stand against things. So I hope that's the case, but I do share some of DR's cynicism as well. And, you know, we're seeing so much, I guess, fake news and alternative facts going on. And how much of sort of, you know, it's getting pushed back where people are sort of, you know, being asked to give loyalty you know, to their bosses and as far up as that goes. And maybe not being, I would hope that judges are and the court systems are going to honor truth.
I think this is rapidly blossoming into an enormous 5-hour discussion. We'll have to impanel some judges to discuss this. I mean, I think that this new guy on the Supreme Court is clearly a very, very smart, very well-read political hack, right? He's there to do a job, which is to support this sort of right-wing agenda. He's not, and all claims of, oh, you know, I listen to every case individually is a bunch of hokum or malarkey, as someone would say, right? They have a very strong attitude, and that's going to come out. I think that's at least at the Supreme Court level, is the kind of danger of this sort of highly divisive time we live in.
I'll just respond briefly to Mariah's point. Think of what Trump did to Judge Gonzalo Curiel, how he demonized him and sicked all these people on him. Think of the demonization that was inflicted upon the four judges in the majority of the marriage equality case, the Goodridge case in Massachusetts. I mean, Roderick Ireland was one of the judges in the majority. His own barber attacked him. He did an interview with him.
Really?
He was getting grief from his own barber for ruling in favor of marriage equality. And you have to ask yourself, you know, considering the forces that are opposed to marriage equality, considering the forces, you know, opposed to Judge Curiel, they would be dwarfed by the power of this industry and the sort of hell it would bring upon any sort of judge that challenged the power of that industry. That's why I'm so cynical about the court, about the legal solution to this.
Well, I tell you, any listeners who have an opinion to talk, either agree with DR or disagree with DR, you can go to the Facebook page and put a little comment and say, you know, thumbs up to DR or DR, here's why. I mean, God, DR, I hope, I mean, the last bastion of rationality is the judiciary. I hope you're wrong, but man, it's scary.
Seriously.
All right, kids, we got to put it down there. The clock is ticking. We'll put up links to at least some of the stuff we talked about. Mariah, I don't know if you folks have noticed, but Mariah has been writing these fantastic blogs the last few weeks. Mm-hmm. I deeply appreciate it. So if there's a three-sentence...
Give me good work. Good stuff to work with.
If there's a three-sentence blog, I wrote it. When there's a thoughtful blog, Mariah wrote it. Anyway, you can find that on the on our webpage at massclimateaction.org/blog. You can get to that if you go to the Facebook page at /MassClimateAction. You should like us or whatever it is, friend us, like us nowadays. You can listen to this podcast directly on your smartphone using Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Overcast, Podbean, SoundCloud, all the other directories. You can find us on iTunes. And, of course, you know, this work is all done through the Massachusetts Climate Action Network, to which you can donate if you go to the website, massclimateaction.org/donate. Please, if you like this show, you know what to do. So we'll close where we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the reckless policies of the new administration not be accepted as normal, and that the United States put a long-term and equitable price on carbon. So thanks for being here, DR.
Thanks.
Thanks for being here, Mariah.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks to everyone for listening. Have a great week. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us. And until next time, be green.
Very cool.